This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
We're proud to be here with our allies in the fight for affordable health care.
I'm Andy Seaton, KBOO News.
For KBOO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KBOO's Afifa Amin Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
KBOO's Eduardo Delanderos Piede has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KBOO News.
I'm Michael Newman, KBOO News.
I'm Courtney Dillard, KBOO News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, this Wednesday, Portlanders will gather at Terry Shrunk Plaza to demand an end to corporate free trade agreements. New Orleans held its first post-Katrina elections on Saturday, and Canadian government representatives will meet with Six Nations Native negotiators to resolve a land claim dispute.
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq, as of today, there have been 2,389 officially acknowledged deaths of American soldiers, with as many as 48,000 others wounded. IraqBodyCount.org reports over 38,000 civilians have been reported killed by military intervention in Iraq. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, April 24th, 2006. I'm Isaac Kaplan-Woolner.
And I'm Lisa Lewis. This weekend at 1:30 p.m., Portlanders will gather at Terry Shrunk Plaza to demand an end to corporate free trade agreements. KBOO's Trillium Shannon spoke with Dan Denver of the Portland Central American Solidarity Committee.
You know, it's just important to emphasize that people don't migrate for fun, and that wherever across the world, whenever you see military aid or capital, industry, economic power moving across borders, you're going to see people and labor also moving across borders. It's a sociological fact.
So what countries is the United States focusing on now with that military aid in South or Central America?
Well, right now, Colombia is the largest recipient of U.S. military aid in the Americas, and it's no accident that part of the strategy of consolidating the power of the wealthy elite in Latin America is by signing free trade deals with Colombia as well.
And can you talk a little bit about what's going on in Ecuador?
Well, the deals that Bush and his corporate allies are trying to push with Colombia and Peru are part of a broader framework intended to be the Andean Free Trade Agreement, AFTA. And so it's been signed with Peru and Colombia, but the Ecuadorian government has yet to sign a trade agreement with the United States, in large part because the people of that country, particularly the indigenous communities, led by CONAIE, the Confederated Nationalities of Indigenous Peoples of Ecuador, have, for weeks and weeks and weeks on end, a few weeks ago, shut down the entire country with blockades and mass protests, despite the intense government repression they faced. And their message to their president was very clear: do not sign a NAFTA-style free trade agreement with George Bush.
What is our responsibility here as U.S. citizens or residents of the United States? How can we make these connections, and what can we do about it?
One of the most important things we can do, as the former Sierra Club president David Brower said in 1994 when NAFTA was being put into effect, he noted that rather than complaining about immigration from Mexico, the U.S. could stop causing it. And that's a really important thing to emphasize, that it's extremely hypocritical for all of these people who supported CAFTA, including James Sensenbrenner, the person who authored the most viciously anti-immigrant bill in the House, H.R. 4437. The irony and hypocrisy is amazing to, on the one hand, be forcing immigrants to migrate into this country by through destroying their economies, and on the other, blaming all of the problems that free trade causes for Americans: underfunded schools, low wages, loss of collective bargaining power for unions, underfunded social services, blaming all of those huge real problems that we do have, blaming them on immigrants instead of where the blame is deserved, which is corporations, a corporate-friendly government that's not willing to tax corporations, and a free trade that has radically reduced the bargaining power and wages of U.S. workers. So people need to stop blaming immigrants for these things. Immigration is a symptom, not a cause of the problem, and blame the cause, which is free trade and the entire neoliberal economic model.
And how have our senators and representatives in Oregon weighed in on these issues?
On immigration, both Wyden and Smith have not been great leaders on doing what we need them to do, which is not more border security, not a guest worker program. What we want is legalization and a clear path towards citizenship for all undocumented workers in this country, and neither of them have stepped up to the plate on that. On trade, they're both horrible. Both Wyden and Smith voted for CAFTA, a Democrat and a Republican, and we really need to hold them accountable for that because it's hurting all workers in Oregon, whether documented or undocumented. An important point about legalization and getting citizenship to the 12 million undocumented people in this country is that one thing NAFTA did was created a three-tier labor system. On the top of that tier were documented American citizens. The second tier were undocumented workers in the U.S. And the third tier were the extremely low-wage workers that U.S. corporations were now using in Mexico. What we need to do to make one tier of labor that's organized and strong is A, put an end to free trade agreements, and B, to legalize undocumented workers.
What do you recommend that people here in Portland do in order to support that?
Well, of course, there's the big May Day rally for immigrant rights. It's part of the Paro Nacional, the general Latino strike that's going to be going on May 1st, and it's going to be huge in Portland, and that's going to be starting at 10 a.m. downtown, probably at the South Park block, so I'll have more information on that later. But this upcoming Wednesday, April 26th, there is going to be a protest beginning at Terry Shrunk Plaza, Southwest 3rd and Madison, which is part of a National Day of Action for Trade and Immigrant Justice. And our central demand is stop the hypocrisy, free trade forces migration. We demand fair trade and civil rights for immigrants. And we're going to be marching from Terry Shrunk Plaza to the offices of Senators Ron Wyden and Gordon Smith to demand an end to the hypocrisy and real immigration reform, which means an end to free trade agreements like NAFTA and CAFTA and these upcoming free trade agreements with Colombia and Peru, and legalization and a clear path to citizenship for all undocumented immigrants in the country.
For Trilliums Longer, unabridged report on this week's Congressional Call-In Day, go to our website, www.kbu.org. Don't forget that next Monday, May 1st, is a national strike in solidarity with immigrant workers. Stay tuned to KBU for more on next week's national strike.
Governor Kulongoski has signed Jessica's Law, a measure that increases criminal penalties for sexual predators who victimize young children. The bill passed during last week's special legislative session. The new law increases mandatory minimum sentences for offenders convicted of first-degree rape, sodomy, or unlawful penetration if the victim is under 12. The new law sets the minimum sentence at 25 years. It also requires the state to supervise such offenders actively for 10 years after their sentences and to track them for the rest of their lives. Oregon is one of nearly two dozen states that have passed some version of Jessica's Law. They are modeled after one in Florida that was named for 9-year-old Jessica Lunsford, who was raped and killed by a convicted sex offender.
Governor Kulongoski says he will ask the Bush administration to restore safeguards for nearly 2 million acres of roadless national forests in Oregon. The Clinton administration prohibited logging and road building on the more than 58 million acres nationally. But the Bush administration later abandoned that protection amid legal challenges. The Bush administration established a roadless policy requiring governors to submit petitions outlining the undeveloped forest lands they want to see protected. Kulongoski said in a statement that the lands are part of every Oregonian's natural heritage. He called the forests priceless treasures that provide critical habitat for wildlife and fish. He said Oregon would suffer irreparable damage from road building and logging.
Transplanted Oregon green building technology is helping rebuild New Orleans and could change the way cities rebuild after future disasters. KBOO's Noah Eaton reports.
The reconstruction of New Orleans is getting an Oregon twist. The Oregon-based aid organization Mercy Corps is transplanting green technology developed here to neighborhoods devastated by the hurricane. Instead of leveling damaged houses, workers take them apart piece by piece and salvage and reuse whatever they can. Sarah Chenven with Mercy Corps' Gulf Coast Hurricane Recovery Program says it's a more environmentally friendly option, and it preserves the city's history at the same time.
Because there are so many historic homes and buildings in New Orleans, it would be a much wiser use of people's time and money to pursue taking down the destroyed buildings and then rebuilding the city, as opposed to just flat-out demolition.
Chen Ven says the Pacific Northwest leads the nation in green building opportunities, and other states should follow our lead.
Problems with the environment is part of what caused the disaster to be as grave as it was. So it's a great opportunity to apply a lot of the lessons already learned in the Pacific Northwest.
Chen Ven says a salvage method, known as deconstruction, also helps the area economy by providing less expensive quality building supplies and more jobs for the local people involved in taking the houses apart. Content was provided by the Oregon News Service. I'm Noah Eaton, KBOO News.
Hundreds of African-American families with kids have left Portland schools and jumped across Interstate 205 into East Multnomah County schools. The number of African-American students throughout Portland's suburbs is increasing, but the surge is most evident in outer East Portland and Gresham. Close to 1,100 African-American students have enrolled in the past 5 years, roughly the same number who have left Portland public schools. Richard Lykin, a demographer at Portland State University, pointed to changes in the housing market as a main driver of the shift. In addition to those drawn by cheaper housing, others are seeking safer neighborhoods or fleeing the uncertain future of their neighborhood schools.
It won't be completely finished until Memorial Day, but the first of seven works along the Lewis and Clark Trail designed by famed artist-architect Maya Lin was dedicated over the weekend. The Cape Disappointment installation will include a basalt fish cleaning station, trails, a viewpoint, and interpretive plaques. Best known for designing the Vietnam War Memorial in Washington, D.C., Lin told the crowd at this weekend's dedication that the platform and fish cleaning station show the importance of the Columbia River estuary. Chinook Tribal Chairman Gary Johnson blessed the site, which was once his people's westernmost village. All the Confluence Project sites, five in Washington and two in Oregon, are to be completed by 2008. The works were originally scheduled to be in place in time for the Lewis and Clark Bicentennial.
A unique effort is unfolding across the United States to raise awareness of the plight of Ugandan children. First, a documentary film on the issue called Invisible Children is currently touring the U.S. Then this weekend, a nationwide event is planned. Reporting for the KBOO News, high school intern Spencer Raymond checked in with this dispatch from Syracuse, New York, on the next weekend's Global Night Commune in solidarity with the children of Uganda.
What's going on at Syracuse University tonight is this showing of the Invisible Children. And this is a national movie tour, and what's it about is this big problem going on in Uganda right now. And what's happening there is there's the remnants of civil war that's been going on there for years, and the LRA, or it's called the Lord's Resistance Army, are really causing some problems. And what the Ugandan people are tired of is the civil war, so they have tried to stop the fighting. And so, but the LRA, they want to keep fighting because they are stubborn and don't want to submit to the Ugandan leadership right now. So the only army that they can get are these children. And so what they've been doing is abducting children out of their homes, out of their villages, and taking them away to their camps, brainwashing them, and creating children soldiers, a child army. And so basically what the movie Invisible Children is about these three American students who went over to Uganda. They went to Africa just on a summer trip. They learn about all these kids and what these kids do in order to prevent from being kidnapped and brainwashed is every night they have to commute, sometimes up to 5 miles, 10 miles away from their homes to these safe houses to sleep at night all together so they can be protected by the Ugandan People's Defense Force that was created to help fight the Lord's Resistance Army. And when they're protected by them, they can sleep safely. And so the whole problem is that all these children have to commute for miles to find safe shelter to prevent from being kidnapped. This movie has been created when these guys went to Uganda. They made a movie and brought it back to America and said, we have to do something about this. They really wanted to come back later to Uganda and know that they made a difference. And so the movie actually passed through Portland in late March, and tonight it's playing at Syracuse University. And the movie shows kind of the daily life of these Ugandan children, and they are the invisible children. They have to go to these camps, and it shows the conditions of these place, and really it's a call for action. It's now the big event is coming up in about a week on April 29th. It's the Global Night Commute, and that's where people all over the United States will commute to sleep, just like these children in Uganda do, to parks and cities across the country to help help raise awareness about this cause and to help hopefully make things better over in Uganda.
That was KABU Spencer Raymond. Invisible Children airs again in Portland April 27th at the Mission Theater. For more information about next week's Global Night Commute in solidarity with the children of Uganda, go to www.invisiblechildren.com.
City councilors in Lake Oswego are contemplating the first ever citywide ban in Oregon on garden products containing the chemical phosphorus. They contend it's fueling the growth of algae in Lake Oswego. The proposed ban targets fertilizers and other products used to maintain lawns and gardens. Phosphorus runs off lawns into the city's stormwater system, gets into the private lake, and ends up in the Willamette River. Mayor Judy Hammerstad says it's a human action causing pollution and can therefore be altered. Other cities and states are contemplating their own bans. Minnesota has had a statewide ban on phosphorus and lawn care products since 2005. Phosphorus feeds Lake Oswego's foul-smelling algae blooms during the summer.
City officials in Bend want to ban alcohol consumption on the Deschutes River. This after a Bend Elks basketball player died on the river last year. I'm sorry, that was baseball player. Michael Willard was floating on the river with teammates last July 28th when he fell into the water while trying to get off an air mattress. Later tests showed that Willard, who died a day before turning 21, had a blood alcohol content more than twice the legal limit for drunken driving at the time of his death. Under the proposed ordinance, alcohol possession still would be allowed on private riverfront premises, such as backyards and homes along the river, as well as restaurants that border the river. The potential fine for violating the ordinance could reach up to $500.
The man who resurrected Timberline Lodge more than half a century ago has died at age 80. Richard Konstam became ill at his family's cabin on Mount Hood and was taken to a hospital where he died this weekend. To skiers and mountain lovers, he was the brains and vision behind the restoration of the lodge, the first ski area in the country to be designated a National Historic Landmark. Konstam took over management in 1955. Built as a public works project during the Depression in 1937, the large timber and stone building had been badly neglected. A private memorial service was held yesterday.
The current time is 5:18, and still to come on the KABU Evening News, the Illinois General Assembly is about to use a little-known rule to initiate impeachment proceedings against President Bush. New Orleans held its first post-Katrina elections on Saturday, and Canadian government representatives will meet with Six Nations Native negotiators to resolve a land claim dispute. You are listening to Community Radio, KBOO, in Portland, Vancouver, Corvallis, and Hood River.
The Illinois General Assembly is about to use a little-known and never-utilized rule of the U.S. House of Representatives, which allows federal impeachment proceedings to be initiated by joint resolution of a state legislature. Five specific charges are being levied against President Bush, including one felony. The felony charge, that the NSA was directed by the president to spy on American citizens without warrant, is not in dispute. Should the bill, dubbed H.J.R. 0125, be passed by the Illinois General Assembly, joins a growing chorus of voices calling for censure or impeachment of President Bush, including Democratic state committees in Vermont, Wisconsin, New Mexico, Nevada, and North Carolina. An ABC News Washington Post poll conducted April 6th through 9th showed that 33% of Americans currently support impeaching President Bush.
Mr. Bush, Iran had a great democracy in the world in 1953. CIA overthrew such a government. It was a model of democracy. Is this the democracy you bring to us?
Bush's visit to California wasn't to discuss the Middle East, but to raise $1.5 million for the Republican National Committee. Tickets were priced at $25,000 a pair. While Bush has proposed to increase the spending in education, he has also proposed to completely eliminate the commodity program that provides food and health care to the nation's poorest populations. Activists criticized the president for spending nearly $10 billion a month on the occupations of Iraq and Afghanistan while cutting health care services at home. Siwa Keeley is with the Committee to Save Indian Health.
He wants to eliminate health services in urban clinics.
In Irvine, California, Bush spoke about immigration reform. Shava Bustamante with SEIU 1877 says Bush is scapegoating immigrants.
George Bush and his right-wing Republican cronies in the Congress are trying to criminalize immigrants, and we're saying it is time to stop the war abroad and at home. It is time to stop the war against immigrants.
For FSRN in California, I'm Christina Onnested.
House Speaker Dennis Hastert and Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist sent a letter to President Bush today urging him to order an investigation of possible price gouging by oil companies and gasoline retailers. But price gouging is only part of the story. Last week, the Center for Public Accuracy released a report on America's addiction to oil. KBOO's Lisa Loving spoke earlier today with Alex Knott, political editor at the Center.
Well, I think it really shows how big of a situation this is. Oil prices are at a numeric high right now and are really close to eclipsing the all-time high when you take in cost-of-living adjustments. And it has an effect on everything. And that's why you've seen these Republican leaders, both Speaker Hastert and Senate Majority Leader Frist, stepping up to the plate and writing a letter to the president urging him to order an investigation about the potential for price gouging by oil companies. I think the real situation here is that people have realized that oil affects the modern family in so many different ways. Sure, it definitely affects the prices at the pump, but in addition to that, it also affects the costs for goods that are transported. So a gallon of milk or a loaf of bread are going to cost more because of the transportation costs associated with that. These things cause an overall inflation. And when inflation happens, the Federal Reserve increases interest rates. That can have an effect on the housing market. So as funny as it sounds, the fact that gas costs more today at the pump could mean that your house is actually worth less tomorrow.
I think that what you just said about the value of your house actually being affected by it is a perfect example of sort of a surprise in what all this research means. Is there anything else along those lines that people should be keeping their eyes on?
Sure. Well, campaign contributions are very interesting and they're easily understood. People often don't understand lobbying. And let me tell you, $343 million has been spent between 1998 2004 by oil companies lobbying the federal government. Now, when you think of lobbying the federal government, you often think of the various people going up to Congress and lobbying that way. Well, these oil companies have also lobbied the Department of Energy. They've lobbied the Executive Office of the President and a whole host of other agencies. So, ExxonMobil has spent nearly $60 million of their own corporate money. These aren't donations. This is corporate money that shareholders and the chairman of the board is signing off on, $60 million to lobby the federal government. They wouldn't be spending this corporate money unless it paid off as an investment. You know, while you have the situation of price gouging that's taking place and the question of supply and demand, I think it's very interesting to know that we recently have, all the oil producers out there have recently hit an eight-year high on supply side. In other words, there's more oil, actually crude, that's available right now than there has been during the last 8 years. So when people say, oh, well, you know, supply and demand, that does play a role. But the fact that we're at an eight-year high and that the prices have swelled so much really shows how the futures market and all the other speculation that investors play a role in is making the cost of oil and gasoline go up at the pump. It's basically this. People realize that you have all these sordid situations in Iraq and similar situations brewing in Iran. And that has driven a lot of investors to buy oil. And for that reason, the price has swelled quite a bit internationally on the markets, which has allowed oil producers, oil companies like ExxonMobil, and the people that are filling up your tank, whether it's Shell or BP or Chevron, to raise gas prices as high as they are. And this recent letter from the leaders of both the House and the Senate really shows the severity of this effect on the nation as a whole.
That was KBOO's Lisa Loving speaking with Alex Knott of the Center for Public Accuracy. For the complete report, go to publicintegrity.org on the World Wide Web.
A new study finds that more than a third of breast cancer survivors gradually stop getting their annual mammographies. The study's lead author says it may indicate women grow complacent about medical screening once they get past the medical scare. Others say it's more likely survivors avoid screenings because they dread a recurrence of the cancer and additional treatment. The study found that just 63% of women were getting annual mammographies 5 years after breast cancer surgery. The findings are reported in Cancer, a medical journal published by the American Cancer Society. Few studies have looked at how often breast cancer survivors get mammographies. One medical expert says, quote, "The assumption has been that once women have had breast cancer, they're going to recognize the value of a mammography and get it done."
A Houston jury today began hearing a long-awaited testimony from the ex-CEO of what was once one of America's most successful companies. FSRN's Lisa Cohen reports from the courthouse.
Former CEO Ken Lay took the stand today in the Enron trial in Houston. He appeared eager to assign responsibility for the collapse of Enron to others, namely the, quote, "deceit and activity of Andy Fastow," unquote, short sellers, who, according to Lay, conspired in early 2000 to make Enron their number one target, and the Wall Street Journal, who Lay claims had information even Enron didn't have in October of 2001, just 3 months before bankruptcy. When asked by his attorney, Max Seacrest, if he took any responsibility, Lay responded, "I accept all responsibility for everything that happened at Enron. I can't accept responsibility for illegal activity I had no knowledge of," unquote. Lay faces 6 counts of conspiracy, securities, and wire fraud with a maximum 60-year sentence, and a second personal bank fraud trial to begin 2 hours after this jury begins deliberation. From KPFT, I'm Lisa Cohen.
The jury in the Zacharias Moussaoui case is now deciding the fate of the Al-Qaeda conspirator. Deliberations began after prosecutors and defense attorneys in suburban Washington made their final arguments. Prosecutors said putting Moussaoui to death would put an end to his, quote, "hatred and venom." But defense attorneys countered that execution would make him a martyr. They said a better punishment would be life in prison. Moussaoui is the only person in the United States to be charged in connection with the 9/11 attacks. Earlier this month, the jury decided Moussaoui was responsible for some of the deaths on 9/11, even though he was in jail. Now it must decide if he deserves the death penalty. During the trial, Moussaoui has been unrepentant. He has also mocked the victims and their families.
The state of California is grappling with the medically and ethically torn question of how to put inmates to death. Executions are currently on hold pending a federal court hearing into whether California's procedure causes excessive pain. Today, Human Rights Watch released a report declaring the lethal injection methods used in 36 states to be negligent. As the California Report's Judy Campbell found, states have long struggled to find an appropriate, humane way to kill.
When a federal judge in February halted the execution of convicted murderer Michael Morales, the decision reverberated across the country. Jamie Fellner is director of the U.S. program of Human Rights Watch. She says the judge is applying unprecedented scrutiny to the lethal injection procedure.
It has pulled the cover off of what has really been a very secret process in the United States, the process by how we kill people.
Over the years, states have tried different ways of executing inmates. Each evolution in the method has been an attempt to eliminate something gruesome about it. Think back to hangings and bodies twitching at the end of a rope. After that, UC Berkeley law professor Franklin Zimmering says, came two new methods.
Electrocution and gas, which turn out to be horrendous when you start thinking about them. But each one was considered to be a scientific advance.
And so was lethal injection, says Zimmering.
Really, it was a Ronald Reagan idea. You go back and you find in 1973, Reagan saying, gee, it's no big deal when the vet comes out to put down a horse or a family pet. Why couldn't we have something like that to make execution more humane and therefore less objectionable?
Legislatures adopted the new modern process.
When you read the legislation that created lethal injection in many states, it reads like television ads. They talk about ultra-fast-acting barbiturates. It sounds like an Anacin ad. What you attempted to do was to say, hey, this is a scientific as well as a humane method of ending life.
But Zimmering says there never was any real science behind the procedure. Jamie Fellner with Human Rights Watch says Oklahoma developed the protocol and over time 36 other states copied it.
We have not been able to find any state that did research into the nature of that protocol and whether or not it would in fact cause the least possible pain or suffering.
That process, developed 30 years ago, is the one used now. A massive dose of barbiturate knocks the inmate out. A second drug paralyzes all voluntary movements. The third stops his heart. Is it painless? Well, say a chief of anesthesiology were about to be executed.
I would want, in concept, this approach being used.
Ronald Miller heads anesthesiology at UC San Francisco. He says the amount of barbiturate used in California should put the prisoner far beyond any pain or discomfort.
The dose of thiopental they use should be more than adequate.
Is it the most humane way that we know?
I can't think of any way that's better.
In fact, no one disputes that. Given correctly, the three-drug cocktail should be a painless death. But witness statements documented in the Human Rights Watch report suggest there have been problems. Witnesses have reported needles falling out, inmates with open eyes, gagging, or convulsing. In some California executions, witnesses reported chest movements long after breathing should have stopped. This suggests the inmate might not be fully anesthetized when the extremely painful heart-stopping drug is administered, unless there's some other reason for these kinds of movements.
I don't understand why there should be marked respiratory movement in somebody who has gotten a very large dose of thiopental and pancuronium. That doesn't add up for me. So there's something that I must be missing.
It's hard for Dr. Miller or anyone to know exactly what happens because though California keeps execution logs, there's no doctor administering the drugs or monitoring the patient. To go back to Reagan's thought that execution should be like putting a pet to sleep, that's not how a pet is put to sleep. Michael Payne, a veterinary pharmacologist at UC Davis, says vets closely monitor animals.
A veterinarian typically would monitor their vital signs, reflexes, heart rate, respiration, to ensure that the animal was unconscious.
In California, the people performing the execution are in another room behind one-way glass. Nathan Barankin with the state attorney general's office says the state will do all it can to ensure the process is safe and humane. But he says it's wrong to apply medical standards where the goal is to protect the life and health of the patient.
In the criminal sentence world, the considerations are different. It's carrying out a sentence that has been handed down by 12 jurors and a judge. It's not a medical procedure. It's the carrying out of a criminal sentence, and there are different considerations involved.
Human Rights Watch is calling for a scientific and medical review of the procedure nationwide. Next week, in a San Jose courtroom, California scrutinizes its own lethal injection method with evidentiary hearings in the case of Michael Morales. For the California Report, I'm Judy Campbell.
The current time is 5:40. And now, daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Memo to Karl Rove. Never again let George W. be posed with a real George W. George Washington. An AP photograph recently ran in several newspapers. A headshot of W. giving a talk in the White House. He was in the forefront of the picture, looking his goofy self, while our stately first president appeared to be just behind him, peering sternly at George. It was only an oil painting of Washington that loomed from the wall to the right of Bush's head, but the contrast between number 1 and number 43 was as unflattering for Bush as if the real man had stepped forward from history and stood beside him. The contrast was all the more striking because, on this very day, the White House was scrambling to explain yet another of Bush's lies. This one was George's flat-out claim in 2004 that he had no idea who had authorized the leak of some classified CIA information to reporters, a leak meant to discredit a prominent critic of Bush's Iraq invasion. If there's a leak out of my administration, barked George W. back then, I want to know who it is. If the person has violated the law, that person will be taken care of. But oops, it now appears that the authorization came from the leaker-in-chief, Bush himself. Rather than tell the truth, however, the Bushites proceeded to lie about the lie. White House PR flack Scott McClellan began flemming and flamming as fast as he could go, claiming that since Bush has the power to declassify government secrets, any information that he might have okayed to be leaked was, ergo ipso facto and presto changeo, not really classified. This is Jim Hightower saying, this is a version of Nixon's imperious assertion that when the president does it, that means that it is not illegal. One thing for sure, George W. is a whole lot closer to Nixon's ethics than to George Washington's. And that's why Carl should never let little George be pictured with the big guy. Today's commentary is made possible in part by the good folks at Mother Jones Magazine. Over the years, Mother Jones has won just about every award available while ticking off the honchos of business and government. They're proud of both distinctions. Find out more at MotherJones.com.
Stay tuned for independent native news following our newscast. Then at 6 p.m., hear Labor Radio. At 7, it's Time Sound with Kevin Berry. Tonight's weather, partly cloudy with lows 40 to 45 degrees. Corvallis can expect mostly cloudy skies and patchy fog, low of 44 degrees. Hood River will be partly cloudy with a low of 45 degrees. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy with highs around 65. Corvallis can expect mostly cloudy skies and a high of 64. Hood River will be partly cloudy with a high of 71 degrees. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News, Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River.
Canadian provincial and federal government representatives say they will meet with Six Nations negotiators in 2 weeks to draft a plan to resolve a land claim dispute. Nearly 2 months ago, Six Nations members near Hamilton, Ontario, reclaimed a piece of land next to their reservation, which they say was illegally taken from them in the 18th century. FSRN's Hillary Lindsay has more from the Six Nations blockade, where protesters continue to hold their ground after nearly 2 months, despite hundreds of Canadian police surrounding the area.
The Indigenous people of Six Nations blockaded a construction site where Henko Industries had begun building luxury homes. This construction site is central to the current conflict between the Canadian government and the Indigenous people of the land. Carol Bomberry, resident of Six Nations, says the land Henko wants to build on is part of a much larger territory called the Haldimand Tract, a tract of land which the Indigenous people of Six Nations never surrendered to Canada.
They want to have thousands of homes in here, 2,000 homes, and they'd be right next to us, and we're just not happy with that. We want the building to stop. We'd like the government to pay off these houses over here and leave us alone. They owe it. It's ours.
On April 20th, the Ontario Provincial Police, or OPP, performed a pre-dawn raid on the blockade site. According to witnesses, police came in with guns drawn and arrested several unarmed protesters. As Hazel Hill describes, it didn't take long for the community to respond, reclaiming the blockade.
Within like a matter of a couple hours, we had an enormous amount of support of the people, and I think that's what the OPP didn't understand. We were continually called a small group of people. But this here, what's happening is the voice of the Six Nations people, and that includes all of our Six Nations brothers and sisters who are living in other territories outside of Grand River. And when they came in, there was only a few, but when the people got together, we marched them out of each camp. The last vehicles from the back came out, they got on the road, and they all proceeded in a line. Our people were marching behind them, drumming and singing.
Mike Laughing left his own Mohawk reserve of Akwesasne, also in Ontario, to lend his support to the Six Nations blockade.
But I'm doing this for my kids, because I don't ever want to see this ever again. Yeah. But enough is enough.
Yeah.
No more. Standing on the back of an Indian too long, too many centuries.
Yeah.
It's time to get off and let us stand and be proud of who we are.
Yeah.
No matter what kind of birthrights was given to us in the beginning, those all need to be restored, because we never signed them away.
The Six Nations blockade remains on red alert. Hundreds of Canadian police are in the area, and there are fears and unconfirmed reports that the Army will be called in. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Hillary Lindsay with co-producer Stefan Christophe in Montreal.
Panama's president is appealing to his citizens to support the biggest expansion of the Panama Canal since it opened in 1914, making way for huge new cargo container ships that can carry twice as much cargo. The project, which will be put to voters in a referendum later this year and is expected to cost $6 billion, would add a third series of locks big enough to accommodate the world's largest cargo ships. The biggest ships that can pass through the canal's current locks are known as Panamax vessels and can carry 4,000 cargo containers. They barely fit in the locks, which are about 109 feet wide. The new locks would be just under 180 feet wide to allow passage of post-Panamax ships, which carry 8,000 containers. The government argues that the wider locks are key to protecting the role of the Panama Canal in its crucial income-generating capacity.
Kathmandu continues its fifth consecutive day of a curfew. FSRN's PC Dubé has more from Nepal's capital, where the curfew has been shortened to 7 hours.
The Nepalese monarch made a royal proclamation on the evening of April 21, claiming to return power to the people and inviting the pro-democracy seven-party alliance, SPA, to form the new government. International community, including USA, India, and European Union, hailed the king's willingness to relinquish absolute power. But the protesters were furious at the king's offer and dubbed it as a ploy to perpetuate monarchy by dangling carrots of power to the political parties. Protesters continued throughout the night, and on April 22nd, Kathmandu witnessed ferocious protests where demonstrators marched within half a kilometer of the royal palace. It appeared they would swoop on the palace and bloodshed would ensue. But the thousands of soldiers had barricaded the area with tanks and contained the march. By late afternoon on April 21, Saturday, SPA leaders had spurned the king's offer and declared that the strike and protest would continue until their demand for the Constituent Assembly to draft a new constitution is met. Many political observers claim that the SPA were on the verge of accepting the king's offer to join the government, but they backed down under pressure of the Maoists, who have been the backbone of the general strike and protest since April 6. Sushil Shashank, a scholar of tribal polity, says the SPA cannot be credited with the apparent success of the current agitation, especially in Kathmandu.
Maoists are the main force behind the success of these protests. These protesters have come from adjacent mountainous villages. Around 80% of them belong to the Tamang tribe. Some 3 million Tamangs dwell within 50 kilometers radius of Kathmandu. They have been against the current ruling Hindu dynasty for a long time. During the past decade, the Maoists' influence over them has grown by selling the dream of an autonomous, self-ruled Tamang province.
Even Dhirendra Shrestha, an engineer whose family has been in the forefront of the Nepalese Congress, the largest constituent of the SPA, attributes the protest success to the Maoists, forcing Tamang and Vote tribals to join the agitation.
Outside of Kathmandu, all village areas are inhabited mainly by Tamang and Boti tribes. Maoists go there from house to house and ask them to go to the protest marches. That's why they are coming out of fear.
But Ram Ekpal Chaudhary, a Tharu tribal political analyst, does not swallow such a thesis and claims the current movement is the progeny of the SPA.
Maoists are extending only moral support. Protesters are not indulging in any sort of violent activities. If Maoists had infiltrated the protest, they would have been killing too. They also have weapons. It was a good time to kill police and soldiers.
Whatever anyone says, Nepal has reached a critical threshold. Anything can happen at any moment. Tomorrow's mass rally is being trumpeted by SPA leaders to mark the most radical watershed in the politics of the country. SPA leaders are hoping some 2 million people would join the rally where they could declare the revival of the parliament the king had dissolved 3 years ago. The SPA leaders could also declare to form a parallel government which would begin the process of the Constituent Assembly. But many fear that the king would declare an emergency and jail all political leaders. King Gyanendra still commands the total loyalty of his royal army.
The Nepal Royal Army consists mainly of four Hindu castes, Brahmin, Chhetri, Takuri, and other Hindu-Aryan origin castes. The cause of the dominance of these four castes is that a soldier must be at least 5 feet and 3 inches tall for getting a place in the army. But the Mongoloid origin tribesmen are maximum of 5 feet 2 inches in height, so they are automatically chucked out. Actually, the monarchy is surviving only because of the support of the army.
The only defense against the royal autocracy lies in a possible UN intervention. But this is not an easy option. India and China may not release such a scenario. Both the countries want the monarchy to survive as a constitutional cosmetic to prevent Maoists from grabbing control all over this strategic region, serving as a buffer state between the two giant neighbors. Even USA is in favor of such a dispensation, but the pro-democracy parties appear to sing the Maoist tune of creating a republic after dismantling the monarchy. In Kathmandu, I am PC Dubey for Free Speech Radio News.
7 car bombs killed at least 8 people and wounded dozens in Baghdad today as talks continue over the formation of a new government. FSRN's David Enders reports.
The attacks came after a weekend during which some Iraqis expressed cautious optimism that the new prime minister-designate, Jawad al-Maliki, might be sincere and able in his promises to rein in sectarian violence. But in a show of the power of newly formed militias, it was announced today that people in Al-Bamiya, the Sona neighborhood in north Baghdad that saw heavy fighting last week, had reached an agreement with the Iraqi army that the neighborhood's militia would not attack the army as long as the army agreed to prevent the Iraqi police, who were viewed by people in the neighborhood as little more than Shiite death squads, from entering. In Baghdad, I'm David Enders reporting for FSRN.
That's the KBOO Evening News for Monday, April 24th, 2006. If you have any questions or comments about what you've heard this evening, please call us at 503-231-8032 and leave a message on extension 203. Or send an email to pmnews@kboo.org. You're listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kboo.fm. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Kirk Vanderveer. Our assistant producer and tonight's audio editor is Noah Eaton. Special thanks to reporters Noah Eaton, Lisa Loving, Spencer Raymond, and Trillium Shannon. Our engineer is John Delderfield. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. Proudly serving Portland's community radio, I'm Isaac Kaplan-Wolner.
And I'm Lisa Lewis. Stay tuned for Independent Native News. And coming up tomorrow morning at 7, hear the KBOO Morning News. At 7:30 on the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show, the guest is journalist Greg Palast, whose forthcoming book is Armed Madhouse. At 9 on Between the Covers, host Jim Schumach interviews Kay Gibbs, author of The Life Around Me by Ellen Foster. At 9:30 on Words and Pictures, hear Dan Piaro, surrealist, painter, illustrator, and cartoonist. He's best known for his cartoon, Bizarro. At 10, Terry Wiley of Oregon Tradeswomen discusses how that organization helps promote success for women in the trades. At 10:30 on Stage and Studio, members of the Artist Repertory Theater discuss Assassins by Stephen Sondheim. And at 11 o'clock, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman.
This is Independent Native News for Monday, the 24th of April. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
Two Alaska Native corporations are reacting to the potential loss of tens of millions of dollars in military contracts. As INN's Robert Hannon reports, the Army has decided against renewing sole source contracts with the corporations after problems were cited in a Government Accountability Office report.
Chenega Integrated Solutions and Alutiiq Security and Technology are defending their records, providing security to scores of military posts in Alaska and across the country. The companies have sole source contracts worth up to $100 million annually. But earlier this month, a GAO report recommended the Army stop using sole source agreements and instead open up the contracts to competitive bidding. In a one-line response, the Army concurred. The report also cited problems with the work of some of the security contractors. Two other non-Native private corporations provide military security services. The Native corporations were eligible for sole source status under the laws written to boost disadvantaged businesses. And thanks to Alaska's congressional delegation, fiscal caps on contracts were removed, allowing the corporations to attract deals worth tens of millions of dollars. Both corporations say they'll compete in the open bidding process, and both say despite minor fault finding by the GAO, they have provided quality security service. For Independent Native News, I'm Robert Hannon.
FBI agents are assisting Red Lake Tribal Police in northern Minnesota, involving reported threats made by students at the Red Lake School. Few details are available about the threats, but the schools were put into lockdown status last week, and FBI agents were in Red Lake last Wednesday. The Grand Forks Herald reports that all the schools had been in lockdown mode since Tuesday, including the building that houses elementary and Head Start students. Lockdown means students are not allowed to leave the school during the day, and elementary students are not allowed recess. News of the lockdown comes more than a year after the Red Lake shooting tragedy. In other news, in northern Wisconsin and Minnesota, Anishinaabe spearing and netting groups are preparing for spring fishing. What many may not realize is that those reaffirmed treaty rights are closely linked to two Lakutere Chippewa brothers. Nick Vanderpie of the Superior Broadcast Network has details.
During the 60s, Mike Tribble had many run-ins with the law, both on and off the Lakutere Reservation, about hunting and fishing.
So by the time we got to my house in Hayward, we were converged on all sides by DNR, city cop, state cop, and even a Department of Revenue agent or something. And consequently, we get arrested for fishing out of season.
The Tribble brothers were angry. They believed they had rights to hunt, fish, and gather wild rice in roughly the northern third of Wisconsin. They took a course from Larry Leventhal about Indian law. Fred Tribble remembers.
I said, well, what do we have to do, you know? I thought we had to just hunt and fish and trap on inside the boundaries of the reservation. He said, well, he said, you guys got to have a test case. Oh, yeah, what does that mean? He said, you got to go out and get arrested.
Strategizing about this, the Tribble brothers dragged their fish shack out on Chief Lake, just outside the reservation boundaries. The next morning, Fred Tribble was busted by Wisconsin State Conservation Wardens. After initial defeat in federal court and violent boat landing protests in the late 80s and early 90s, the U.S. Supreme Court in 1999, in the case Mille Lacs versus Minnesota, reaffirmed Chippewa treaty rights. According to Mike Tribble, treaty rights remain important.
For our grandchildren, our grandchildren's grandchildren, we must continue to keep our fight for our treaty rights. It's going to be an ongoing thing.
I'm Nick Vanderpie on the Lakutere Reserve in northern Wisconsin.
This is Independent Native News. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
Supported by Amerind Risk Management Corporation, a Native venture protecting Indian Country's assets. www.amerind-corp.org. Independent Native News is a production of KUAC.